35. In 1936, Dawnford Yeats wrote the following letter to his readers.
To my customer. There are some old-fashioned tradesmen who send their customers cards, well printed in copperplate, on which they beg to thank them for their continued patronage, a highly respectable practice now falling into disuse. I have no such elegant cards, and if I had, I shouldn't know where to send them, because I can't tell who my customers are. But I beg that they will believe that I esteem their patronage very high, and that I mean what I say when I offer them one and all my respectful compliments and thanks.
Clubland Heroes. Iron to Win presents a series of portraits of the creators of the Clubland Heroes, heroes who are still often portrayed in the cinema and on television. This week, he examines the books of Dawnford Yeats. It was a crowded party with a strong literary flavor, and I found myself discussing favorite novelists. I mentioned one Clubland hero, Fapper, and the guest with whom I was talking countered with another, Dawnford Yeats. Suddenly, we were back in that halcyon decade before the First World War. We were fondly recalling the Pleydell family and reliving the Ruritanian thrills that Yeats created in his Chandos series. How, I asked that party guest, Tony Treble, did he get hooked on Dawnford Yeats?
Reading the Cyril Connolly volume, I came across the famous phrase, a wit that is ageless and a courtesy that is extinct. And this came in an essay by Connolly called The Novel Addict's Cupboard. And since I'd had reason to thank Connolly for his tips before, I thought, well, it's a rather odd phrase, and perhaps it's half ironic, but I will try Dawnford Yeats. And as luck would have it, and it was luck, I think, I hit upon the so-called Mansell books, or the Chandos books, the series of adventures in which three gents do daring deeds, usually at the expense of rather spectacular villains.
Swiftly, I stepped to the window, pushed the casement open, and put out my head. The sill of the window was low, and I do not like heights. I recoiled instinctively. Then I took a firm grip of the stonework and looked out again. I was at least 80 feet up. Directly below me, the balustrade of the terrace was joining the wall of the tower. Since the terrace was 20 feet wide, I was exactly that distance from the edge of the roof of the house. This edge was well below me, I made out, about 40 feet. The sill of my window projected a short 2 inches beyond the face of the tower, and I saw no other projection of any kind. I sat back on my heels and wiped the sweat from my face. Sheets or trapeze? Only an ape could have leapt to the roof from my window. The bare thought of such a venture made me feel weak at the knees. I shall never forget the masonry of that tower. It presented no handhold at all, within or out of my reach. Frantically, I tried to look upward, craning my neck. And then I saw the drip course. Not to make any bones about it, my case was this. If I stayed where I was in my cell, the game was lost. Jenny, Virginia, Mansell, all three were doomed. And I should very soon die at the hands of Vanity Fair. If I could make good my escape, the four of us might be saved. If I sought to escape and failed, we were no worse off than before. In a word, I had nothing to lose, not even my life.
So I read my way through all the Chandos novels, and I love them because they've got a kind of glamour, and glamour is a quality not appreciated fully in my view. By glamour, I mean a kind of heightening. I like the Rolls Royces. I like the vast great country houses. I love the chateau in which the heroines are incarcerated. So I got all the way through them, and I read them again from time to time on holiday. And I thought, it's no good just sticking to Chandos. I will try the other volumes. And it turned out there were three distinct categories. There were the very incurred books, there were the Chandos novels, and there was a general large category of mostly romantic thrillers is the best way to describe them, I think.
So what do we know about the man who wrote all those books, over 30 in fact, and created a world that captured a following of millions. His real name was Cecil William Mercer, and 20 years after his death, he remained something of an enigma. No two researchers into his life have arrived at the same conclusions. But of his family background, there can be no argument. He was born on August the 7th, 1885, at Wellesley House, one of a row of decent Georgian houses behind the castle at Walmer in Kent. His father was a solicitor, descended from a line of solicitors and naval folk, who had offices in Walmer, Ramsgate and Deal, while his great-uncle George was a local patriarch and reckoned to have the best legal practice in the district. A.J. Smithers, who's currently working on the first ever biography of Dawnford Yeats, takes up the story.
He started life with something of a tragedy, because in 1891 came the great scandal. And it turned out that George Mercer and his brother-in-law had been milking the clients for years. George blew his brains out in Deal. Brother-in-law James was sent to prison for 7 years, and the firm went bankrupt to the tune of £70,000. And that rubbed off rather badly on Cecil John, Dawnford Yeats's father, who had to clear up the mess. It was nothing whatever to do with him. He wasn't in the firm. And I think on the strength of that, they found Walmer not too pleasant a place to live in. R. Yeats had been to prep school there and was ripe to go to on to his public school. They desperately wanted him to go to Harrow. So father and mother sold up everything, moved to Harrow. He set up a little practice in Harrow, and Bill Mercer, as he was called, went to Harrow as what they called a day boarder. And there he came much under the influence of Norman Kenneth Stephen, probably the most notable English master in any public school of his day, the man who taught Winston Churchill English and to whom Churchill refers in some of his earlier books.
In his later years, he was to make a habit of mingling events in his own life with the actions of his characters in books such as Berry and I Were Saying and Berry and I Look Back. After Harrow, the young Mercer went to Oxford, where he preferred amateur theatricals with the Ouds to serious study, coming down with a miserable third in jurisprudence.
That was a bit of a blow to the family. The father wanted him to go to the bar, but you can't easily get into the bar with a third. So he was set to work in the city with the Yates side of the family, the multiple grocer people. And he worked in the city in their warehouse in Clerkenwell for the better part of a year. And at the end of that time, his father got him into the very famous and still existing firm of Wentler and Sons, who are solicitors to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. And there he learnt a very great deal. He was in the middle of the suffragette riots, for example. He saw Mrs. Pankhurst claw the policemen's faces in Whitehall. But after his year with Musket, in which he'd got a very encyclopedic knowledge of the workings of the Metropolitan Magistrates' Courts, he was then allowed to go to the bar. And there he was very lucky, because at Musket got him into the chambers of Travers Humphreys, who, of course, as Mr. Justice Humphreys, was probably one of the greatest criminal lawyers of this century. And he worked under Humphreys for some years, but he was always on the fringes of things and never actually in them. But his real case, the one that broke his heart, was Crippen. You see, what happened was Mercer was playing with the old stagers in Canterbury, happened to go back to Chambers, and there were the Crippen papers just come in. Well, as he was perfectly entitled to, he got his hands on them, took them to Humphreys, who was head of the Chambers, and reasonably enough assumed that he would get the junior brief, for that was the custom. But he didn't get it. Instead, it went to, again, quite a famous man, Ingleby Oddy, because Oddy was one of the very few men at the bar who had a medical qualification. And, of course, a lot of the Crippen case turned on medical evidence. And Humphreys and Muir naturally wanted somebody who could tag their gowns when medical questions cropped up. So Mercer was cut out of Crippen. That hurt him very much indeed.
So with his legal career in the doldrums, what was he to do?
You see, he couldn't make a living at the bar. Very few young barristers could in the days before legal aid. And there were a number of perfectly acceptable things you could do to jack your income up a bit, and one of them was writing.
And he wrote a short story that he tried on the Windsor magazine. It was called The Busy Beers. You'll find it still in The Brother of Daphne. And Windsor loved it. Well, I think he intended The Busy Beers as a kind of one-off story, because it ends up quite plainly with Boy Pleydell, who's his own, obviously, sort of alter ego, married to Madrigal Stukely, and he then had to unmarry him again shortly for the second one, so he quietly forgot her until later on she was married off to somebody else.
I said earlier that Yeats was an enigma. Indeed, different people have formed very different opinions of him. The critic Richard Usborne, for example, corresponded with him while working on a book about the Clubland heroes.
My feeling is that he was a great snob and wished to be richer than he was, thought more highly of than he was, would like people to know that he was a member of the Cavalry Club and as a country gentleman, didn't want particularly to be thought of as an author, a scribbler.
Then there's the novelist, Tom Sharp.
He hit one of his servants for leaving a curtain open so that the sun shone on one of his favourite paintings. He did him so badly that this man brought an action against him, and Mercer went to court in Poe and pleaded that he was a brave English captain whose nerves had been shattered by the war. Well, he hadn't seen a great deal of action on the war. There was no question about this action having taken place, nor the fact that he'd beaten this man extremely badly.
Jack Smithers doesn't agree with either Richard Usborne or Tom Sharp.
Well, everybody agrees that he was always immaculately turned out. He was very formal in his address. He didn't make friends easily. And he was certainly untroubled. He was a member of the club in Poe. He went there from time to time. But he was never the kind of man, even when he got to be quite famous, to push himself forward. Well, it wasn't his style at all. But to his immediate household, he was an austere figure. Could be almost frightening at times. But he has come out of things since his death worse than he deserved.
To Yeats, England had reached perfection in the years immediately before the First World War. His characters enjoyed private incomes, retinues of servants, and with increasing frequency as the years slip by, we find them complaining that the world is not what it was. Much of this had to do with Yeats's own circumstances. From the early 1920s, he lived the life of an expatriate, first in the Pyrenees at Poe, then immediately before the Second World War, a little further away at Aubon, where he built a house called Cockade. That house is immortalised in one of his very best books, The House That Berry Built. His world was a world in which only the best was good enough, a world epitomised by the king of cars, the Rolls-Royce.
The Rolls sailed through the country, proudly indifferent to hill or dale, melting the leagues to miles with such swift deadliness as made you sorry for the lean old road that once had been so much to reckon with. I was on the point of communicating this quixotic reflection to Agatha Dario, who was seated in front between Jill and myself, when there fell upon my reluctant ears that heavy sigh which only an expiring tire can heave. As I slowed up, it occurred to me that the puissance of the roads of England was still considerable. "Which is it?" said Agatha. "Offhind, I fancy. We were in the midst of a pleasant beechwood, and I pulled into the side of the road with a grunt. If it had to be, it might have happened in a less pleasing locality." "I gather," said Berry's voice, "I gather that something untoward has befallen the automobile. Should I be wrong, correct me and explain the stoppage." "With that singular clarity of intellect which never fails to recognize the obvious, you have correctly diagnosed the case. You have picked up a puncture." "Speak for yourself," said Berry. "I always let him lie. I did gather a bunch of births once, but..." "Sorry," said I. "I forgot how near we were to Oxford. What I meant was that some hostile body of a sharp nature has penetrated the tire, thus untimely releasing the air hitherto therein confined." "Thank you," said Berry. "Experience leads me to anticipate a slight delay, the while you effect the necessary repairs. I shall therefore compose myself to slumber and meditation. Possibly I shall toy with a cigarette. Possibly..." "Your program will, I fear, miscarry for more than one reason. In the first place, you're sitting on the jack. In the second place, clumsy fool though you are, Jonah can change the wheel quicker if you help him. And with that, I climbed out of the driver's seat and lighted a cigarette. Who, I added, will come for a little walk.
Not that Yates himself was much of an expert. One of Richard Osborne's friends recalls seeing him taking delivery of a new car.
One day, a Rolls Royce was driven up to the door. This was the new car that Yates was going to buy and had sent to him on approval. And out of a window, this fellow looked at Yates as he walked round the car to make sure that he wanted the car. The final thing before he, so to speak, nodded and signed the check was to unscrew the lady on the front thing, look inside the radiator, screw it up and say yes. I've never known much about cars, and I sometimes catch myself saying things which I only know because I read them in Yates about water on the magneto. No, 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 you can't. I don't believe cars have magnetos now, do they? I got prepared to say that. If you get water on the magneto, you're stuck.
Yates had begun by writing various stories, but by the mid-20s, even he realized that he was writing of a world that was gone. He could also see that Buchan, Sapper, and even Edgar Wallace, whose work he despised as being of indifferent quality, had found a vast market for thrillers. Yates set to work, and the Chandos series was the result. He took Jonah Mansell, already known to his readers from the Berry books, and created thrillers that owed much to Anthony Hope, and in particular to a story by another Victorian favourite, Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island.
What is nice about them is that the heroines are always fairy tale heroines who get into the clutches of ogres. It's that kind of fantasy, I think, which makes their attraction. Three good men and true on the track of a delightfully awful villain who is incarcerating a delightfully pretty girl. They move very fast. The characterization isn't too generous, except in one particular occasion, the villainous Vanity Fair, who comes and chivalry among thieves, is a very, very great figure indeed.
Some 200 miles from here lives a lady. Once her surname was Blonde, and since she was christened Vanity, you won't be surprised to learn that somebody very soon named her Vanity Fair. And though she's no longer young, the nickname has stuck. Before you were born, that name was a household word. Diplomacy. For years, she set the rivers of Europe on fire. She was a dazzling enigma of every embassy. Nobody knew in whose service she really was. No court dared deny her entry. She held positions of two at the very same time. And then, to the general relief, she saw fit to retire. I mean, into private life. Vanity Fair has a reputation of being one of the cleverest, most unscrupulous, and most ruthless women alive. The death of her second husband was very sudden, and from time to time, several other people who were known to have given her offence have come to untimely ends. There is not a tittle of evidence to connect her with their respective fates. But the series of coincidences is curious.
I'm interested in the development of these sort of figures from the great progenitor, maybe, Anthony Hope. But when I'm trying to convince people to read them, they say, I've read the first couple of pages, and they're awful. Nothing else but Rolls Royces and servants and lots of money and nobody works. And indeed, I had quite definitely the fairly appalling first paragraph of An Eye for a Tooth, which begins, I had just been sent down from Oxford for treating two avowed communists in a way most people thought they deserved. And this does open up rather or in the common parlance, a fascist view of human affairs. Nevertheless, I find Chandos & Co. much better company than I do, let's say, James Bond or Fleming's recent rivals.
Unlike Buchan or Wallace, Yates left no straightforward autobiography, but the literary detective has a host of clues to follow in the Berry books. Who, for instance, were his literary influences? Anthony Hope, certainly.
Both kinds of Anthony Hope, the Dolly dialogue, frothy stuff to begin with, the Prisoner of Zenda, the Rupert of Hentzau, yarns that are suitably adapted and turn out in his own kind of thing. If you set Stanley Weyman's books about the Pyrenees, Under the Red Robe, Gentlemen of France, and the others, alongside Yeats's books, you'll be hard put to it to tell who wrote which. And of course, the same goes for Henry Seton Merriman, who was closely associated with Wayman. But another influence is undoubtedly Saki, Hector Mundo. He, as you probably know, was Yeats's cousin. Mercer had an enormous admiration for Saki. All the little funny Berry stories, the start of Once There Was a King That Did Some Funny Thing or Another, they're nearly all straight Saki.
But from wherever he derived his inspiration, Dawnford Yeats was a stylist, rivaled among the Clubland heroes only, I suggest, by the early Leslie Charteris. Not only can he thrill us, he can also make us laugh.
Dear brother, it is within your knowledge that some 3 weeks ago, this household was suddenly deprived of the services of its cook. This out of a clear sky, and if we may believe the police, in one of those uncharted purlieus which shroud in mystery the source of the Cromwell Road. For 22 unforgettable sultry days, we have endured the ghastly pleasantries of charwomen better qualified to victual the lower animals than mankind. To call the first meal breakfast is sheer blasphemy. Lunch is hollow mockery. Dinner, the abomination of desolation. I do what I can with grape nuts and a gas stove in the bathroom, but the result is unhappy. And last night, the milk was too quick for me. I therefore implore you to collect a cook in Paris without delay. Bring it with you when you come, or better still, send it in advance carriage paid. Luxury shall be heaped upon it, its slightest whim shall be gratified, and it shall go to the movies at my expense whenever I am sent tickets. Can generosity go further? Wages no object, fare paid back to Paris as soon as Mrs. Mason's leg can carry her. Brother, I beseech you, take immediate action. The horror of our plight cannot be exaggerated. So something, anything, misrepresent facts, corrupt the honest, warm faithful, but procure a cook.
And I think this is a tragedy of the man, that he, you know, he wanted to belong to that group of people. And he's always harking back to a golden age, which never really existed, but which I think, is, you know, as a lonely boy, he probably created in his own mind. And he tried to live up to the standards of this. He has this odd mixture of a sort of punctiliousness. At the same time, there is another side of him which is very clever, very cunning, which I think, you know, he uses in his plots very well.
Incidentally, that was something which Woodhouse thought was quite extraordinary, that a man could reveal himself to the extent that Yeats revealed himself as boy. He used to scratch his bald head. Extraordinary, this man can get away with this sort of autobiographic sentimentality.
His will, as becomes a man with legal training, was carefully thought out. In it he left particular, even peculiar, instructions as to one of his chattels, a picture clock. This was a landscape painting of a church in rustic surroundings, with the church clock being a working timepiece. Jack Smithers says that it was very much a Yeats talisman. He talked to it regularly, discussing his problems with it. No wonder, perhaps, that in his will he left instructions to Mr. Woodward, a jeweller, to remove the clock from the picture, sever the gongs, dismantle the movement, and destroy the parts to the satisfaction of his executors. The picture and the clock, I suggest, knew too much.